Welcome to Congress Two Beers In. It's been a little while.
It's been a minute.
I mean, we had the shutdown, we had a snowstorm, we've had a few things, and then we just had a bunch of random scheduling errors. But we're back, and we're going to talk first, I guess, about the spending deal? Question mark.
Yeah,
right?
Let's do it.
Are we recording right
now? We are right now.
Oh,
we can edit a lot.
I thought we were brainstorming.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, this is going to be a live brainstorm session.
I mean, this is...
Yeah, it's going to be on the fly.
Yep.
Right.
There it is.
We're not in a normal space. Right. Literally, no. Somebody has taken our podcast room.
We're not.
We've named him Carl. He's there. We're in a different room, so if it sounds weird, we apologize. But I want to talk about the spending deal, which actually got done. So this was a bit of a surprise, at least to me. I don't know about you guys. When we were going through the shutdown, we're like, this looks really ugly. We don't know how we get out of it until something really bad happens. Something really bad happens. And then you're like, well, maybe they'll start working on a deal. But unlike other shutdowns, this did not include a deal for overall spending levels or anything like that. So there was no obvious sort of next step after that. So since mid-November through basically early January, we didn't hear much of anything from Congress. We heard people were talking in like back rooms and that they were, you know, working on negotiations, but like really nothing really hard and firm came up until late December. And then all of a sudden, like, the House and Senate start releasing deals one after the other, and comes out of like four minibuses popping out in rapid succession. And Congress looked functional in January for a hot second. And so, I mean, I guess my first takeaway was the committee system and appropriations process worked when you just left it alone.
I mean, this was kind of a better than expected outcome given how Congress had been functioning. Also, I think there's a lot of credit due to Tom Cole and appropriations for a lot of this, you know. I mean, he's kind of the archetype of the guy that you want to be in charge of this sort of thing.
Right.
And, you know, also notably, Congress pushes back against the wishes of the administration in a lot of different ways. That being said, notably, they don't recapture power over appropriations in the way that, you know, the Senate Democratic bill that was voted down multiple times until Thune had enough during the shutdown would have done. Different goalposts, but in terms of spending levels, there is a modest reassertion of congressional power. After a blip of a couple of days after the 30th, most of those bills get passed except for DHS. I think we're in stream of consciousness catching us up to the present now, right? Is this the summary you want, Josh?
Well, let's talk about the politics of it for a little bit, because they're a bit unusual, right? I mean, there have been zero... Republicans have not been able to pass spending deals. Like, that's been the sort of, like, the bulk of the problems with government spending, at least in Congress, for the last decade plus, right? You only get, like, 70, maybe 100 Republicans, 150 maybe, to sign on to a deal in the House, and then you get some in the Senate to sign on to a deal. But, I mean, these things have not been popular. And Republicans came and backed these bills with huge numbers comparatively from where they've been the last decade. It was a really impressive sort of like blend of kind of conservative priorities that got a significant chunk of the caucus or the conference back on board. And that was a big change from what we've seen since John Boehner, really. And one of the reasons that they were able to do that is because the overall bills actually cut spending a little bit,
a little bit
across the board, right? Almost every agency got basically a haircut. So that was a win for a lot of conservatives. I mean, like the hard line, like Chip Roy's and everybody, they're not going to get on board with that. But that was a really big win for conservatives that you actually saw a decrease in funding in an appropriations deal. So that got a bunch of conservatives on board. What was interesting is that Democrats were also on board for sort of like details, right? So conservatives got spending cuts, Democrats got details in terms of line by line numbers, program by program, like tables and how much money should be spent on those programs. There were some restrictions on how much people they can fire, how many people they can fire, how much reorganizations can be done. They kind of put limits on, they required a lot of agencies to staff back up. So Department of Education, NIH, HHS, the National Endowment for the Arts and Humanities, all of them are required to staff back up to their previous numbers, or at least numbers where they can execute their statutory functions.
And
so
we'd love to train you all.
Right. So it's sort of like, it's sort of a interesting mix, right? Democrats kind of put some restrictions on the executive branch. Republicans get some spending cuts. I mean, obviously not everybody's happy about the deal. But
I thought the administration was the big loser here. Like, once again, Trump has
proven himself basically incapable of having any leverage with Congress over the appropriations process. This is now a 6-year story with him where their idea of what should be in these appropriations bills at both financial levels and authorities just is being rejected by Congress and always has been. And I think the story here was that the appropriators were never super far apart. They were within sort of money-cutting negotiation room, which is they're good at that. And the shutdown wasn't really about funding levels per se.
Right, yeah.
And neither is the holdup at DHS now per se. And so given the opportunity to cut a deal, they cut a deal. And I agree with everything you said about sort of the shape of the deal. It's Congress reasserting itself with a little bit of control of this stuff, rejecting Trump's sort of basic
right.
program. I think that's probably the big story coming out of appropriations, you know, whatever we are, 14 months into Trump 2,
right.
is that the sort of heady days of spring 2025 when Trump was just going to, like, unilaterally become spending monarch. Those are gone.
Yep.
Those days are over. The administration has done a fair amount to cut staffing and employment in the executive branch, but they've done almost nothing to cut resources. And in some question is like, well, what are the less people going to do with more resources, right? We're going to get more efficient government out of it.
Right.
I think you'll get degraded services in some spot. But those days of Russ Vogt sort of deciding that we're going to just have impoundments left and right seem to be over.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that the administration has had, this is happening within a context of them winning a lot of fights from the outside and having outside incursions do, whether it's the pocket rescission that the Supreme Court is blessing or other sort of major cuts. I mean, Trump and Vogt are both salivating over the idea of an impoundment case going to the Supreme Court.
I fundamentally disagree with that. Their lawyers will not defend impoundment in the courts. They do it in public all the time, but they are dead set against doing that, and every time they're in the courtroom.
Yeah, I respectfully disagree, but I think that'll be kind of an interesting thing to
the
see.
The two big cuts they got, Congress did. Like, the rescission packages, which weren't that much, you know, $10 billion or whatever, was done by statute. Like, they
blessed things that they had already done, that the executive had already done. Yeah, the 9.3, the HR3, they referred to, yes?
Yeah, I mean, they used the law. They used the process Congress set up, and you know, there you are. I mean, the pocket rescissions are a problem, I guess, but they just don't seem that interested anymore in doing this stuff. And the place where, like, the most acrimony was at NIH, and they backfilled all that. It all got spent. And so I don't know how to think about the administration on this count. They were talked a big game, but it seems to me like Trump was more sort of just had a burr up his ass about federal employees. Because he hates those educated liberals who stock the agencies in D.C. And that, for him, is what this really about, is punishing those people. But, you know, like, Trump was never into balanced budgets. Trump was never into cutting aggregate spending. And so, like, if you're going to have to slog through every Tom, Dick, and Harry in the House to cut a little bit out of this program or that program, it's probably more than the lift he wants to do.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree that this is not cutting aggregate spending. You know.
No, it's the opposite of that.
Yeah, it's the opposite. He's
If you add in the BBB discretionary spending, they actually don't cut spending.
Yeah, not at all.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it has been interesting to watch. One of the things that's been, I think, a little bit overplayed is, like, Congress has lost its power. And you heard that a lot, and it certainly seemed like that. And, like, a year ago, we would be like, oh, well, yeah, Congress looks pretty irrelevant to, like, spending decisions right now. But it's important to remember, I think it was a good Tom Cole quote, right? Mm-hmm. The idea that Congress lost its spending power is just wrong, right? Just because it's just a matter of if they want to use that power or not, right?
Sure.
Like when president had just been elected and he had a lot of wind at his back and, you know, kind of political capital in his sails, they were willing to kind of go along with a lot of these really intense maneuvers that they were going with and unilateral maneuvers, and now they're just not, right? They've kind of backed off that. They don't want to support those types of things. And it's never like this case that Congress like loses it. I don't think there's short of a constitutional amendment, I don't think Congress is going to lose its appropriations power. But surely its willingness to actually execute it or exercise it is a different matter altogether.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think there's a distinction here that's been annoying me a little bit when people say that. Like, why won't Congress do something? And sometimes the answer to that is that Congress is actually, like, not doing something when it might want to. Other times, it's doing something. It's doing everything it can, right? Like, it voted against the tariffs. It voted against the war authorities in a lot of spots. And they just don't have the votes,
right,
right, to hit the supermajority thresholds they currently need. Other times, they're not doing anything because Congress agrees with the president.
Yeah.
Right? On the ICE stuff, majorities in both chambers agree with sort of the, you know, the deportation policy at the grand level, right? So arguing Congress should do something is arguing I don't agree with Congress and I wish they thought differently than me. But I think those things can be separated out, where Congress has been somewhat assertive, I feel like. And I think another problem people have is that they think Congress has to pass a law in order to change executive policy, right? And that's just wrong, right? And it can be everything from Greenland, where a couple phone calls saying stop fucking around, idiot, change the policy, to oversight hearings where, you know, that changes direction, or just Congress as the aggregator of public opinion, which I think is what happened with the ICE stuff, and sort of shifted, you know, executive policy.
Yeah, I mean, we still don't know, like, what's going to happen with the DHS bill, and you have substantial chunks of, you know, voters or public opinion that would, you know, public opinion is changing on ICE pretty rapidly. That being said, most Republicans still agree with what the, you know, agency is doing.
Right, what the agency did was back down, right? I think most people looked at it, and I think Congress is the aggregate opinion. It's like, why the fuck are you fighting with liberal protesters in the street of a northern city?
Right.
Go find the people to deport. And so, like, the policy changed. And is that because of Congress? Some people are like, well, that's just public opinion. Like, what is Congress if not the aggregation of American public opinion in some sense?
Yeah.
And so I don't credit Congress with that, but that's where it's channeled into in some ways. And
one of the things
I mean, I think the DHS bill will be a standard for how much that is true or is not true. I mean, because I think we have different examples of that being more versus less true. I think the appropriations that we just saw get passed was a good notch in the belt for Congress. Like, this is good pushing back. This is good, you know, policymaking in a more regular fashion. Gosh, the bar for that is, like, just non-existent anymore. But, you know, if you look at the number of Republicans voting for HR1 last July, you know, this is a bill that's underwater with their own voters. That's not a popular will vote. That's a, you know, power of the president to, gosh, I'm trying not to do stat so badly. You know, this is Trump being a whip in the House for Johnson, who can't do it without him.
That's the important part here is, you know, without the president needs to be involved in the House if they're going to do anything in the House, because Johnson does not control the House, Republican Conference. President Trump has been, when he's been involved, has been a very effective whip for Johnson, but he's just not involved. And that's one of the things that, you know, is, as we're constantly talking about, like, Reconciliation 2 and, like, the likelihood of Reconciliation 2, like, it was never clear to me that, you know, the president had any kind of wish list for Reconciliation 2, so he wasn't going to be that involved in any Reconciliation 2 effort, which really kind of puts a pin in, like, that that whole balloon, right?
I don't see much of a legislative agenda at all on the Republican side right now. And, you know, it was clear as day, the State of the Union address, like, it just didn't have a lot of legislative proposals there. I mean, people are fixated on the SAVE Act right now, but, like, set that aside, and there's just not that much there from the administration that they seem to care about legislatively, which is not unusual for a six-year president. It feels a little different because it's been a disjointed term, but, like, it wouldn't, you know, you can't, you know, you'd be hard-pressed to find a lot of legislative proposals from Clinton in 1997, right, or Bush or in 2006. So it's kind of, we're kind of at the end of the line anyway, but, like, I think with a bigger margin and a stronger speaker and a more sort of ideologically coherent party, a Reconciliation 2 would have been a real possibility.
Yeah. I mean, that and an administration want to do something.
I think we're in the age right now of the party system where a second reconciliation bill is a very likely scenario of a party that has its act together and has the numbers. And they don't really have either right now, especially with the numbers.
Right.
Well, you also have Trump has floated a $1.5 trillion defense bill. So our colleague Katina Slavkova actually just wrote about this for our newsletter. But, you know, beyond that, in the SAVE Act, there's not a whole lot of suggestions coming out. And whether or not we're going to get a reconciliation bill, I mean, Hal Rogers had said that, you know, he'd love to have, you know, a third of that, you know, $1.5 trillion figure in the reconciliation bill to just kind of, like, make them math work, but whether or not, like, that even happens is a giant question mark and not something I would you know, bet the milk money on.
No, I would not. It's really interesting that DHS continues to be shut down, and it doesn't seem like there's really much momentum to do that. On the one hand, like, we all know why it was shut down, like the events that happened in Minneapolis, like, it basically derailed the whole spending deal, and so they had to, you know, detach DHS or this Homeland Security bill from the rest of the appropriations bills when they were trying to reopen the government. But the DHS bill actually had a lot of provisions, like arguably the most provisions in the language of the bill itself, like the Homeland Security language, that pushed back on the administration, right? There was, you're not going to reorganize FEMA. You're going to release the grants within 10 days of passage. You're going to restaff, like a lot of the organizations that you're going to do. You are going to do, I mean, it was an extensive list. DHS had a lot of pushback in that bill, not necessarily around ICE, although it did with like body cameras and a few other things, but really on like a lot of the other agencies, yeah, where there had been some messing around or some changes. And so Congress reassert like fairly strongly where it is, and that's all in limbo still, right? So on top of like as they try to sort out ICE with stronger protections or stronger restrictions on what ICE and CBP can do, there are a lot of other provisions that are going to affect a bunch of other agencies in that bill, where Congress is really going to push back on a lot of what the executive branch was doing.
Yeah, I think that's a really nice description. I mean, I do think that. And but vis-a-vis ICE, like, they're pretty far away on most of the demands that different parties have. So they all seem to agree that you should have body cameras. They're all in favor of some additional level of training. But the Democratic wish list of, hey, kids, you have to show your faces. You need actual judicial warrants, which, you know, is a constitutionally protected item. You know, ICE officers showing their names, showing their identification. You know, they're just all of the reporting of these talks is that the two sides are very, very far away on this. And so we're going to see the influence of what happens with the money in HR1, the reconciliation bill, OBBBA. Like, I never know which one is the mental term that listeners resound with first. But, you know, ICE got $75 billion, and eventually they are just going to start using it. I mean, like, they had a big super check that was cut to them in what, you know, partway through the shutdown, and they don't have a whole lot of strings on that money. So, you know, I think we're in an interesting area where people are pretty far apart on what to do with ICE, but at some point, like, the powers that be are going to start using the reconciliation money to just kind of like move forward on this. So there's probably some level of a timing sweet spot. I don't know how you guys see this or not.
I think the administration is largely now getting what they want out of this. They've made minimal reforms, and the temperature has dropped in Minnesota because they left there. So they're not getting day-by-day videos of insane things that are crushing them with opinion. And I think so, to a certain degree, I think that this issue seems right now to be going the way the administration wants, which is sort of away with a whimper. And they'll cut some deal in Congress, but I think their fear that this was going to be another, you know, 6 months of this right into the campaign strikes me as probably over. But again, like, I think that's probably a change between sort of the Stephen Miller, Kristi Noem view of what ICE is doing over to the, you know, Tom Homan Lyons and view of what it should be doing. And I think, you know, shock and awe in the streets is out, and sort of that makes it a tougher policy to deal with if you're the liberals, because things about it you may not like that are not quite as unpopular and not quite as visible are going to be tougher to deal with. And it's going to, I think one thing the administration is happy about is moving the bargaining over this away from the incidents, time-wise.
Sure.
And now, you know, whatever we are, a month later or wherever, it just doesn't feel like a crisis anymore.
Yeah.
Even though as a policy matter, probably a lot of it is still exactly the same. But if you don't have people getting, like, kicked in the head in the street, it changes sort of the tenor of the negotiations. And I also think, like, we have a shutdown right now that is the most in-name-only shutdown you can possibly imagine.
Right.
Not only
right.
is there all the money in the BBB, but almost everybody at DHS is accepted anyway, so they're all working. Now, they're not getting checks.
Yeah.
And eventually, the rubber's going to hit the road at TSA.
Right. Well, those are the people I feel bad for.
Right. But it's not...
as does Congress.
Air traffic controllers are in transportation, so it's not going to hit there. And your side of it is some of the ham-handed administration stuff where they're, like, trying to turn the screws by turning off, like, TSA pre-check and stuff, and then they went 180 on that like 4 hours later. Some of that is sort of, I think, sort of shut down politics that has gone awry. But I get the sense that the vast majority of people, even the vast majority of people in Washington, probably have completely forgotten that there's a shutdown.
Yeah,
I think that's fair. Well, I think you'll get some sort of issue extension to the purchase and then use of detention centers, like large detention centers in different parts of the country. But yeah, it's a different visual potentially.
That's like, what are you gonna spend $700 billion on? And that's a major question for ICE. Like, this, the money's just piling up with nothing to do with it. The stuff that's for is sort of these large scale construction projects,
right,
which are coming under heat wherever people want to put them up. There's a weird reassertion of local politics here, which people don't want large scale immigration detention centers in their district, which, like,
slash date.
Right.
Yeah.
Which, like, probably was predictable if you thought about it, but I don't think anyone was predicting that sort
right.
of backlash. And that's another sort of interesting angle to this, because that's one where sort of individual Republicans are going to get angry that the administration probably didn't see coming.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, they've got $45 billion for that kind of stuff from, you know, the reconciliation bill. Like, we're going to see this keep playing out.
Yeah, I mean, again, they're going to have to put those detention centers somewhere, and then senators will pop up and be like, hey, not in my state. Like, hey, somewhere else, maybe.
They have so much money. There's no chance they spend $75 billion in 4 years. There's just no way. It's just not possible. I don't think that agency can ramp up that quickly. Like, they do everything they want that money. I don't know what you're... I mean, you can buy whatever you want, but, like, it's just too much
money.
Going
to have to
money.
Start making, like, the Ritz-Carlton of detention centers, or something.
Show me how you can spend out that much money that quickly on an agency that was, a tenth of that size financially. It's a wild ramp up.
Yeah, it is pretty wild.
Yeah, there was a nice article in The Conversation a couple of days ago about the ramp up of... alcohol enforcement under prohibition, and kind of similarities to, like, in terms of just like programmatic implementation to today, and the ramp up with ICE in terms of, you know, wanting to check people out, wanting to have quality people, wanting to make sure that they're trained, wanting to make sure that they have some level of oversight, and kind of failing on those different counts. And so we do have previous American historical precedent here. That's kind of interesting to learn from.
One thing I did want to talk about while we're here is something that's in front of Congress now, which is the SAVE Act, right?
Yeah.
This is one of the few things that the administration's really, really big on. They want to pass this act, which would be a massive expansion in federal voter registrations, right? In terms of, you need ID to vote, right? That would be a national requirement, and you would also need proof of citizenship to register. So it would be a massive expansion. So the House passed this under a lot of pressure from...
Twice!
Right. They passed it because a bunch of conservatives really want this. The president really, really wants it. So they pushed it through over to the Senate. And the Senate, it's gone nowhere. There's no way in hell that it's going to get past a filibuster. So there have been some musings over in the Senate about doing a talking filibuster. Now, a talking filibuster is taking advantage of the two-speech rule in the Senate, which says that any senator cannot speak more than twice on any given legislative day on a particular topic. And so, theoretically, you could just wait out all the Senate Democrats who are going to filibuster the bill and just wait until they get exhausted and then try to pass it. At least that's the thought. The interesting thing about this is John Thune just quashed this a few hours ago.
Right.
Said there's absolutely no way in hell we're going to do a talking filibuster.
We're breaking anti-news.
He came out early, and it was he was quote-unquote skeptical of the particular idea, getting it through. And now he's just outright said, like, it's basically a dead idea. It's not going to happen, because essentially he couldn't guarantee that four Republicans would not vote for Democratic amendments, and therefore the SAVE Act would not get through under its original revision, which is another way of saying, like, he doesn't have the votes, right? It's just plain and simple, you don't have the votes. And what's interesting about this is that the talking filibuster is like, it's kind of falls under like the Green Lantern theory of Senate procedure, right? If you just try harder, then the thing that you really want will happen. And the talking filibuster is certainly like trying harder and like trying to get something done. But the reality is, like, these things, they're just red herrings, right? They don't actually capture what's going on. And like saying like, oh, well, if you just try harder, you'll be able to get the votes. Like, the people are not going to switch votes because you've been talking for 60 hours or whatever it is. And the fact of the matter is that trying to go through a talking filibuster is actually a lot harder than like nuking the filibuster, right? Because it requires like
infinite times. Right.
You would have to go through and have a majority vote, you know, back you or back like the Republican tactic on every motion to adjourn, on every Democratic amendment, on every. It's just like over and over and over and over again. It's essentially like you have to commit to staying together on a series of potentially hundreds of votes, right? As opposed to just nuking the filibuster and doing this. I mean, the reality is, like, it just doesn't have the votes. And it's not, like, that much of a realistic tactic. And if you willing to go through with this sort of thing,
It fits in this weird branch of the tree, like Game Tree. One is it has this, just like you said, I 100% agree. It fits in that notion people have that, like, in Congress, they haven't thought about the strategies. And, like, right. If they just thought about it a little harder, they'd find ways to do stuff that they can't do. It's like, do you think these people don't want to pass bills like this type? Of course they do. But it does fit in, like, when would you try this? Like, forget about whether it could work. You'd have to have at least 50 votes to do this talking filibuster, but not 50 votes to just nuke the provisions. Not even of like legislative filibuster, but just like controlling sort of an amendment between the chambers provisions to carve this out. And that like doesn't exist,
no.
Right? Like it's just they don't want to change the filibuster and making it to do it the hard way to break a filibuster. They really don't want to do right. Like
right.
If they really wanted this and were able to sacrifice the filibuster, they would just do it. And so I don't think this has ever been there. Ringwis and I were talking about an interesting feature of this is that they can do this without amendments. Like, you can just take a Senate bill, amend it in the House, amend it in the Senate, amend it in the House, and send it back, and that can't be amended.
Right.
Like they could do that. And, like, they don't want to do that, right? Like,
right.
Like, because they don't have the votes.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
It's just saying,
right.
It's like, right. I mean, at the end of the day, they don't have the votes, right? If they're not doing it.
They have 50 co-sponsors,
right.
Which seems like a lot, given
right.
what the legislation is, but they do not have 60.
Right. They don't.
They just don't.
Well, they don't have 60. They don't have 50.
Right.
They don't have, I mean, that's the problem.
No, they
problem.
Have 50 co-sponsors.
Well, that's fine, but they don't have 50 votes. that's the difference, right? You can have 50 co-sponsors, but if you don't have 50 people willing to vote
sure.
against every amendment to the
right.
bill,
I mean,
against every motion
sure,
to
sure,
adjourn.
Sure. That's
like,
something else.
Like,
it's
I mean,
still more
right.
support than I
and on top of that,
most
like,
people would expect.
The thing
that
cracks me up about this is, like, you know, the legislative filibuster, you have to have a group of 50 senators plus a tiebreaker in this particular case that are, like, absolutely determined and intensely interested in the bill and
sure,
achieving
yeah.
the bill and the policy itself.
Yeah.
They're
right.
more interested in than the people
right.
trying to filibuster are against it.
Exactly. In the talking filibuster, you need that, like, 50 to 60 times because you have to have all 50 of those people around the Senate chamber in case anybody makes a particular
right.
motion,
yeah,
amendment,
yeah.
or offer,
yeah, no,
or thing that could... It's just insane, right?
But, like...
Like, we've all been corrupted by Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, right? We think, like, oh, you stand up and people change their minds after you talk a lot. It's like, it just doesn't. It's not the way Congress works.
I blame the Civil Rights Act on this because, like, everyone is convinced they broke the filibuster in the Civil Rights Act. No, they didn't make a culture. They ran up the votes. They ran up a two-thirds majority. It's like, we're done with this.
That's right, yeah.
And Mansfield let the Southerners talk is the other piece of it.
Well, you just have a different Senate.
Yeah, but I mean,
yeah.
but he did let the Southerners talk for 40 days,
sure.
which made it look like there was a really long filibuster that then they exhausted and gave no. They got the votes.
They got the votes.
They got the 67
yeah.
votes to break the damn
yeah.
thing by a culture.
Yeah.
It's real simple. Congress is real simple. It's real simple. If you have the votes, you do the thing, right? And if you're not doing the thing, you don't have the votes. It's just like
yeah.
it's not that hard.
This is also kind of related to something we were talking about earlier, insofar as the administration doesn't have a big legislative push. And so
yeah.
this is a shiny thing that has to do with votes that Trump thinks will make it easier for him to do better, his party to do better in the midterms.
So,
and
well,
so that's
what
we're talking
it,
about.
That's
here.
The interesting
yeah,
thing.
Yeah,
here,
I think that they don't have 50 votes because this would be a nightmare for the GOP.
That's
if
like
the
one crazy about this.
Like,
the parties haven't caught up yet to the
right.
reality of voting.
Right.
Like, the Democrats should want this bill.
That's exactly it. Mitch McConnell is sitting there like, if you have voter ID on every piece of legislative vote out there, we're never going to have any Republicans at the polls. I mean, he sees this as clear as day. The low propensity voters
yeah.
have shifted away from Democrats and to Republicans.
So
and anybody that
right.
has been watching how this has been going, and there are a lot of very smart people in politics on the Republican side of the aisle, know that this would be a disaster for a lot of places, right? It would not be good.
Sure. I mean, You also heard a lot of vulnerable constituents.
That's the main thing.
You also wipe out the vast majority of married women.
Correct.
Which is insane.
But that's all nonsense.
Right.
They're not going to pass a bill that prevents 60 million married women from voting. It's just not going to happen.
In this environment?
This is not a
woman-loving Congress.
I promise you. That's what the legislation says, though.
Right, it does not say
married women can't vote.
It says that you need, for most people, the citizen proving documents to register, not to vote. You need a photo ID to vote, but to register are going to be either a birth certificate or a passport. And for most women, their name is different from the name. Look, Todd wanted to take my last name because he was a wonderful human. Most married women end up taking their husband's names.
But you need those documents to get a passport, and tons of married women get passports all the time. It's like not at a practical level.
50% of Americans have a passport.
Right, but like getting one is not tough for a married woman, right? Like I agree with you, it's a hurdle, but that's not the reason this bill is like problematic. It's one of them.
It's a big one.
The reason I think the Democrats don't like this bill is that it does target specific constituencies of theirs, right? Yep. Like, even though the marginal non-voter is Republican now, and this would be better for the Democrats in aggregate, certain groups that are very important in the Democratic Party, including African-Americans, low-income Latino-Americans, would be hurt by this group more than others.
Right.
And so I still don't think it's long before the Republicans give up on this stuff.
I've been thinking that for a decade.
And the Democrats jump on it.
I don't know.
A basic voter ID law is like, there's no doubt it helps elect Democrats at this point.
Yeah. I mean, and that's the thing. It's like all these documentation, it just puts a greater onus on the individual to get the right to vote again or to access the voting, their voting privileges, voting rights. I don't even know what to call them anymore. And the people who have to do that typically are like better educated, higher income folks, right? And that demographic shifted enormously. But it strikes me as like this is the reason. I'm not surprised that they don't have 50 votes in the Senate because this hurts everybody, and it's not helpful in any way, shape or form.
Well, it's also just good to be against making voting harder.
Correct.
As a general principle, regardless of how it shakes out for you in any specific
election.
Right,
and that's the other piece of the liberal coalition here is sort of highly educated liberals who are like very much not acting in their self-interest here necessarily, but just believe in the reforms of easier voting, right?
Right.
And so that's holding things in. I don't believe the parties are anything but strategic on this, and I think eventually, if it persists, that the marginal non-voters, Republican, the Democrats will come around on this stuff. And we're going to have a period of time where no one's talking about it. And then if anyone's talking about it, we'll be Democrats.
Something that's interesting about non-voters is that like they do diverge from voters in a number of different ways. Like forget this bill for a second. Like just think of the people who manage to show up to vote versus not under whatever normal circumstances is in your head. Voters are older, they're whiter, they're better educated. But interestingly, they have different perspectives on economic intervention in the economy. Government intervention in the economy. Non-voters would prefer a higher level of government intervention in the economy. We've been talking about affordability for a while. You know, different cycles call it different, have it different buzzwords. Sometimes we're really concerned about eggs, and sometimes we call it different things. You know, housing affordability has worsened. We had a bunch of things in the State of the Union, many of which were fact-checked. But it's already harder than it needs to be to vote. In this country, there are people that GAI deals with. We have, lovely people who do camera crew activities for us who have had times in the past where they've been working and haven't voted on a Tuesday because it's a working day of the week for most people. And they're incredibly well-educated, they're incredibly inquisitive, they have points of view, and they're not voting, at least some of the time. We make it too hard, but also like the people who don't vote like would actually want more action on things like affordability.
Yeah, that's right. The marginal non-voter isn't a Romney voter; it's a Hawley voter, and that is That is a pill to swallow that doesn't cut directly across sort of the party system in the natural.
Well, that's because Josh Hawley is an enigma now.
Yeah, I'm not sure I've ever used the phrase Hawley voter, but I agree with what you're trying to say.
Yeah, no, I think economic populism on the right is the marginal non-voter, probably.
Yeah.
And that's the other piece of this, which is not sort of registering to vote or showing ID to vote. It's when voting is available. The president has long believed that and discouraged his own people from voting by mail in other easy ways, and Republicans that talk about that plank. And I really think for Trump, this is about his belief that he gets screwed by late ballots coming in.
Yeah.
That actually like are being stuffed at ballot boxes. Like, right. I really think this all goes back to 2020 for him in some ways.
Yeah, and we're talking about today. They're discussing an executive order to declare a national emergency on voting and potentially do. This sort of thing makes my head.
Maybe IEPA can justify.
Right, exactly. My IEPA can come in and it's going to IEPA the National Emergency Act can justify like national voter registrations from the executive branch. That's going to be a fun court case. It is sort of nuts, and I do wonder like where he's coming from. Maybe he does believe that's the source of his defeats or whatever it is. I mean, he's wrong,
right. But
it's a weird thing to pursue, and I think you're seeing a lot of pushback in Congress for it because it's in fact odd, right? It doesn't kind of match up with
like
reality.
Sometimes pursuing your own rhetoric and pursuing your own interests are not the same thing,
right? Yeah,
you know? But there's also a wag the dog quality with this guy, you know.
No. It's interesting. And speaking of IEPA,
Supreme Court just
had a ruling basically saying that no, the National Emergencies Act does not, in fact, empower the president to issue tariffs or create tariffs. They can regulate imports and exports, but they can't introduce taxes where they aren't there. And this is a bit of an insane decision just because I don't read court decisions a whole lot. I read people who interpret them for me, if that makes any sense. But man, when you read some of these things, you're like, what in the holy banana cakes are people eating or drinking over there? Like, there were a couple in particular that was like, what are we even talking about here?
The funny thing is, like, it's
but,
like,
sorry, go ahead.
It's a shockingly simple case. Like, this isn't a hard case. Like, everyone,
the
president, the administration, all the parties, all the justices, they all agree the president has no inherent authority to tariff anything. And so the only question in the case is, did Congress give him that authority in IEPA?
Yeah.
And, like, the answer from the majority is no. And the answer from the dissent is yes.
Right.
And, like, they're both reading the same statute, and they disagree about it, and that's fair.
Well,
and it took us 170 pages and seven different opinions to explain how they got there, which is nuts.
Right, that was the part that was wild to me. It's like you have a bunch of people who basically agree on basically the substance of the decision but have six different rationales for it, right? And it was like listening to, like, a bunch of daycare kids, like, try to sort out, like, something that was going on the playground.
Yeah.
Right? It's just, like, six people screaming at one another, like, I'm right for the following reason, but everybody agrees on the basic premise of the decision.
Well, I mean, there's a context that has nothing to do with IEPA that has everything to do with SCOTUS and Trump and Biden and the major questions doctrine that they only, you know, first explicitly cited in 2022 with the EPA case. They're trying to make sense of of their own recent history, and like within that political context, you know, like the Supreme Court is a political actor. I think that the ruling of the majority, insofar as like IEPA doesn't authorize this, I think it's kind of transparently obvious that that's the case. I didn't read everything, but I liked Kagan's take that like you don't need to put a major questions thumb on the scale to decide this. You can just say, look, the statute does not authorize this. It doesn't. And I'd love to kind of get away from the major questions doctrine, frankly. I think the waffling in the seven decisions and all of this business has to do with kind of like where we've been for the past couple of years.
I wanted to tell them to fuck off.
Well, one thing I do want to say is, like, we can all agree that whatever doctrine Clarence Thomas was writing about should not be the doctrine. That's like, yeah. He's talking about, like, core legislative powers versus other legislative powers. I was reading this stuff. I'm like, oh my God. Like, what? It's just, I couldn't wrap my mind around it, but I'm glad the court did not go
with that. I thought it was funny that neither Kavanaugh or Alito even didn't sign on to that one, right? Like, he signed on to Kavanaugh.
By himself, like, bro.
He's on his own there. I was disheartened by all of them except Gorsuch, because I think Gorsuch was close to where I would land on this, which is that they're trying to decide whether Congress delegated its power in IEPA, and IEPA is not a statute Congress ever passed. It's a statute Congress passed
as it's operating now.
That the court eviscerated in 1983, yes. Because Congress had already answered this question in IEPA and said, we're going to decide.
Yeah.
Right.
When we've delegated this or not, each time the president uses it, if we don't like it, we'll tell him it's over. And that was a legislative veto that they had in IEPA. And when the courts invalidated the legislative veto, which, fair enough, there's a rationale for it not being constitutional.
Nah, I was stupid.
They should never. They should never have severed it off IEPA and left IEPA in place. They should have struck down IEPA as a whole and said, rewrite this, Congress. Because as now, like, they created their own mess here.
Right.
Like, if the legislative veto was there, Congress would just decide if tariffs were involved in this. And they would say no or yes. And the court wouldn't have to. And now the
Congress has done that, right?
Trying to draw lines that, had they just left well enough alone, Congress would just do the job for them.
Right.
And, like, it's such a nightmare to watch them fumble around this and not even say the word legislative veto in the case, and pretend they're trying to interpret congressional intent.
Right. Well, let's rewind here and explain legislative veto for a second, right?
Terms.
So,
okay.
So the big thing that we're talking about here is the legislative veto was a policy or a provision within a lot of these delegated powers, whether it's IEPA or whether it's the National Emergencies Act, War Powers, yeah. A bunch
from
of different
1932
things.
1932 on.
Right. Regulations that have been put in place, like, there's a bunch of stuff that Congress has delegated power to the executive branch. But when they pass those laws, Congress also included provisions that these provisions are basically not operable if Congress by majority, Congress says not. This is where the legislative veto.
The point is, any time the president exercises authority, Congress deserves the right to, as a Congress, vote to overturn that exercising that authority.
Well, this is where it gets tricky, because what they struck down in Chadha in 1983 was a single chamber legislative veto,
yeah.
Right?
So, the law.
Which essentially says, like, if one chamber of Congress adopts one of these resolutions,
yeah.
Then that delegation of power is no longer valid,
yes.
Right? So that's like the House or the Senate, not both, right? Or the Senate saying you can't do that. Now, other legislative vetoes were just committee specific, so a committee could say, so like, it's not a valid form of
that's
authority, and that you're getting on some fairly dicey territory.
But notice how it works now, because this is the important part. Both the House and the Senate have voted by majority to overturn stuff in IEPA, but because they can't use legislative veto, that now has to be a joint resolution of disapproval, where they have to send to the president and he just vetoes.
So the difference here is the legislative mechanism, right? It, under these previous legislative vetoes, it was a concurrent resolution, which is only passed by the House and the Senate, and that's it. It stops there. It doesn't go to the president for signature. And if Congress passed one of those bills that just passes the House and Senate, then the power was taken away.
Be gone.
By having to do a joint resolution, I guess, has to go through the House, the Senate, and the presidency. And now the president gets involved in whether or not his power has been taken away. And we all know what the answer to that is going to be. No, in fact, my power is not taken away. They'll veto it. They send it back to the Congress to override. But you're never going to get a two-thirds override veto, override a veto, except in extraordinary cases. And this is, I mean, essentially like what Matt's been talking about, sort of like the ratcheting up, right?
Yeah.
Essentially, like, this is not the policy that Congress passed when it created IEPA,
yeah.
Where they could take away power to remove a national emergency if the president uses one outside that Congress doesn't agree with. And then we've seen this in COVID. We've seen this in a variety of other examples.
Wall.
Right, the wall. We've seen it a million different times where Congress has passed by majority vote of both chambers,
sure.
A concurrent resolution,
yeah.
To or a resolution to take away those powers, but then the president vetoes it and Congress can't actually be involved. I mean, it really has handicapped Congress's ability to actually control the delegated authorities that it's
right.
Given
and
the
so
president
now,
for the
now
last,
the,
like,
now the court,
years.
So now the court, which, I mean, and again, I understand the arguments that the legislative veto is unconstitutional, but what you end up with now, particularly with IEPA, is a court trying to figure out what it means for Congress to have delegated something in a law that Congress had set up a completely different mechanism of control, right? And,
right.
Like, it doesn't even matter if you think yes, this has tariffs or no, it doesn't have tariffs, because either way, Congress was going to reserve the right for a future Congress to draw that judgment themselves.
Right, functionally,
well, and in a limited way, that was situation specific. So when IEEPA is passed in 1977, we're in the middle of the Iranian hostage crisis, right? And like Carter's like, Carter wants to freeze assets of bad dudes. You know, we saw this again, we saw its use again, you know, after 9/11 for freezing assets for different terrorist entities or people like so connected. You know, those are situation specific uses, but also like, okay, well, by W, like Chadha has already passed, but you know, you can imagine when Congress is passing this law that they go, oh gosh, we're not going to foresee something like, right. You know, the Ben Affleck.
They can be as vague as they want, right. Because the vagueness doesn't hurt
yeah.
them.
Right.
And that's the really galling part of this, is that even if you decide, yes, this means tariffs or no, it doesn't mean tariffs, what Congress was reserving the right to do was overturn any individual tariff. And if they like some tariffs, you can do it. If they don't, you can not do it. And like, it's... this is so second best what the court trying to do is, but what the court is not trying to do, even Gorsuch, who seems to believe in Congress and his decision making, isn't there going, well, we should revive ways to empower Congress here. Right. Right?
That's the thing, because what you've functionally done is left to the court
yes.
the decisions of when a national emergency is valid or not.
Yes.
And that's like, that's you just handicapped a branch of government,
yes.
right? And we're not, there's yes. no empowerment of Congress.
Now, Congress is not blameless here, because there's a way to do this. That they have refused to do. And now look, when IEEPA was severed, it should have just been declared unconstitutional, so they had to go back to the drawing board, and the president didn't have any authority. But you can do joint resolutions of approval. You could have rewritten IEEPA to say, any declared emergency by the president is over in 10 days unless Congress has a joint resolution of approval. That's what they did with the Reorganization Acts,
sure.
when the legislative vetoes got severed from them. And so Congress could do that. But to me, that is just proof that the legislative branch might as well be constitutional. If Congress drew out a law saying you can declare an emergency, and if we don't approve it within 24 hours, it's over, how is that different than the legislative veto?
Right. It's not.
It's not.
Right.
That gives either chamber an immediate veto over your thing because they have to be approved. But instead, you can't do it the other way, which is the way it was. It doesn't pass the laugh test to me.
Right.
That they could structure that as approvals within 12 hours or whatever. And that wouldn't be sort of the equivalent of legislative veto. So I'm frustrated with the court because they didn't even bring this up. And part of this is, you know, Josh Chaffetz has been writing about this a lot.
Yeah.
A lot of the way to read the Roberts Court is that what they're doing is accumulating power in the courts. Sometimes at the expense of the president, more often at the expense
yeah.
of Congress, but like accumulating authority of the courts themselves, which I totally agree with here.
Yeah.
Yeah, Josh Chaffetz, friend of the pod and opponent of Chadha. Notably.
Right. I mean, I think at some point, if you like really do care about the legislative branch, you oppose that decision. It's like, because it was like, not just
yeah.
like, hey, we're not going to say like it's valid in this one case. We're going to say like any sort of legislative veto
yeah.
at all ever written
no,
like is basically
been,
invalidated.
It been really narrow.
Yeah,
also,
it could
have been. Versus Chadha. Fucking immigration cases.
Yeah, exactly. I know.
I'm the only one drinking here, by the way,
yeah,
dear
yeah.
listeners.
Unfortunately, it's a sad state of affairs over here. But with that, we all know that nobody listens to the podcast more than 48 minutes long. We just hit that. So we're going to go ahead and wrap up. Been great talking to y'all. We are going to try to do this a little bit more regularly.
Let's
now
do
that
it.
We don't
yeah.
have like snow. Imminent major snowstorms in the D.C. area. I know New Jersey, New York, the North, and New England just got hammered. Listen, I have the most to lose out of this, right? I have three young children. That's like them when they're locked home with me, nothing gets done.
Yeah,
but
I don't know. I'm about to go to BJJ after multiple beers. So. Everyone's going to enjoy that.
All right. Well, that's going to do it for us. We will see you next time.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye, guys.